We're in an interview, 28 June 1978, with Mr. McGill. And you're in your log again, there you found another note.
Yes. Aerobatics. Aerobatics. Avro 3 hours, Pup 5 hours and 30 minutes, Dolphin 3 hours and 40 minutes, total 12 hours. This officer has fired 1,205 rounds from the air. Yeah. July the 18th, I went to Turnberry.
Mm-hmm.
So
you lose another month here, or what?
Yes, I lost a month there. Well, it was two days during the month.
Because of the influenza.
Yeah, that's right. Then, when they thought we had enough, and there was a call for pilots in France, they shipped us off to London, and from there, cross on a boat to France.
Well, how did you feel now? I mean, you're finally making the front. The war's been going for 4 years.
Yeah. We're getting over there, and so we all head to what they call a pilot's pool, called Paris-Plage, on the coast of France, northwest coast of France, a place called Paris-Plage, and practically a train load of us landed there, you see.
Now, are you still a sub-lieutenant, or have you been...
Yeah, sub-lieutenant, yeah. Well, no.
Or were you promoted?
No, it's a little bit different now. You see, now we're Royal Air Force.
Well, that's, we've got the change coming in here.
Now
we're
Royal Air Force, and you're a flying officer now.
Flying officer.
Yeah. So you have a band, you have a different uniform, or you still wear your old uniform, it doesn't matter. You know, there are about four different uniforms, you'd see them. The fellows who had gone to the Air Force from the Army, still wearing the Army uniform, but with wings up, you see. And all sorts of uniforms, different colors, either blue or khaki.
Well, what was the feeling when it was changed to the Royal Air Force? Was there...
Well, I think the Royal Naval Air Force sort of weren't enthusiastic about it, because they had a little preference in the pilots they had. They had more training, and they were usually on the northern tip of the front, near the coast, and they were probably bombing Zeebrugge or all this sort of stuff, you see, and they did. Whereas we were down on the Somme, and we had all the fighting to, quite a bit of fighting to do, you see. And, but, as far as the Royal Flying Corps, Joseph, we didn't care which it was.
You personally didn't care?
No, I don't think so. It was something, they had bright new uniforms.
A new uniform. Here's a chance for
but
a new
anyway,
uniform.
We all arrived at Paris-Plage.
And this would be, what date are we talking here?
The date would be, it would be about the 1st of August.
1918.
The latter part of July, or the 1st of August. It would be July, that's right.
Were you aware that the war would be over fairly shortly?
No.
You know the time turned?
No, not
aware
at that time. No, not at that time. Although the big German drive had been stopped, and they were holding and starting to push the Germans back to the Hindenburg Line. See, they burst through the Hindenburg Line.
Yep.
They got back almost to Amiens. But now they were held, and there's one day that the Canadians took 30,000 prisoners.
Right.
And we had started back a bit now, and that's what where it was at when we arrived in France. But
what were the conditions like for you people arriving there?
Well, of course, this was away from the front on the seashore. There's a little seashore place with...
So you're living like princes again, or what?
Huh?
Are you like living like princes again?
Yes, that's right. We had good food there.
Good food.
The best meat went to France, you see. We'd been living in rabbits in England, but here we had beef, you see.
You had to go to France to have English beef, right,
yeah.
Okay.
So, but we arrived there, and you were supposed to wait there until a call from the front, from a squadron. They wanted so many dolphin pilots, or so many camel pilots, or they wanted this kind of a pilot, or so on, and you were shipped out.
You never
were
on a camel now, did you? You were the
dolphin. No, I was never on camel. But the camel was very much like a pup, except the pup was a lot easier to handle. But what did we do to put in time besides eating and sleeping there? Practice gunner. They had a little tiny railroad running around this place on the waterfront with a machine gun on it, you see. And
the small gauge railroad?
Yes, a little narrow gauge railroad, about this wide, you see. And you'd do that, and they'd, there were things all around that you were supposed to fire on, you see. That was one thing, but most of the time that wasn't working. So what they did, they had a bunch of shotguns, and they had one of these...
Are you in the middle of a tape or not?
So...
You got these shotguns.
So, shotguns, you see. And these shotguns were working all day long, and they were only cleaned about once a day. Well, but this 1 week went past, there was no call. Another week went past, there's still no call. And we, another chap and I began to, he was a Dolphin pilot too, began to worry. He said, so-and-so went out, he came in at the same time we did. How come we're still here? But anyway, so we went to the office and we said, how come so-and-so went out and we're still here? Everybody wanted to get out to squadron, you see. They said, oh, well, never mind, you just don't worry, your turn will come. And so back to the shotgun. And you know that when I see a shotgun, that that shoulder just starts to ache. Firing at these clay pigeons all day long, you know, on a dirty shotgun. And that got so sore that in order to fire it, I had to press that butt of that gun just so solid there that I couldn't feel the kick, you see.
Right.
It's only because it was so sore. And I can't look at a shotgun now with that shoulder starting to ache. Day in and day out, clay pigeons. Oh, boy, I got so I could bring down clay pigeons. But anyway, but 3 weeks went by, still no call. So this other chap and I, we went up to the office and we started to raise Cain. He said, look, something wrong here, because there's several people have gone out that came in after us. Why haven't we been called? So he said, well, I'll follow it up. So he went away and he said, your name's not on the books at all. How come? I said, how come? That's what we want to know.
So my shoulder's sore.
Yeah. You've lost us. You've lost us for a good 3 weeks or more here. And he said, all right, your name's on the book now.
You'll be getting out of here.
You'll get the first call out for Dolphins. So that was, I forget, I think I wrote down the number of days anyway, but it was well on towards a month that we lost there. So that's 3 months that I've lost. You see, since we arrived in England, I've lost 3 months. And what's happened? You remember there was a tremendous battle on in April, the latter part of March, April, and the beginning of May. There was about 5 weeks there where aerial fighting was terrific, and they lost about half the Air Force pilots in those 5 weeks, you see. And there was a tremendous demand for more pilots. And so that nearly all the fellows that I started out with arriving in England were shot down in that push.
In that one push?
Yeah. But these 3 months that I lost...
Twist of fate, eh? It wasn't meant to be.
Yeah, must have been, yeah.
My God.
So there you are. But anyway, one day a call came. Two pilots for 23rd Squadron.
Well, this is it, eh?
So that's it. So
23 Squadron, RAF, British Expeditionary Force...
France.
Whereabouts.
Yeah.
France.
Yeah, that's right. So we went out. There was a lorry came first and we were taken out, you see.
Whereabouts was the squadron head?
At Bertangles, that famous aerodrome in France. It had huge wooden hangars. I guess it was the oldest aerodrome, the original aerodrome in France.
Is that
Bertangles.
Right?
It's northwest of Amiens, about, 20 or 25 miles, something like that. Nice flat country there. And there were one or two big hangars. Now I've forgotten which. There was at least one big hangar, big wooden hangar, great high thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so we joined the squadron, introduced. We lived in Nissen huts, these little huts, you see, and so many to a hut.
Well, how did you feel now, finally getting into the action? The war's been going 4 years.
We're back there, but. We just stuck around there for weeks before we became regulars, you see. What they did was...
But to break you into the squadron?
Yes. Well, of course, there were these Nissen huts, and outside the huts were these trenches, you know, like this.
Mm-hmm.
Because we get bombed occasionally, you see, by the Heinies. And while I was there one night, they wiped out a squadron at the other end of the... Some lighter was taken prisoner. And he happened to mention that they showed pictures, movies, you see, on such and such a night. And that's the worst thing he could have said. We presume that's what happened, because they came over and they planted a bomb right in that and practically wiped out the squadron.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. And that was the next squadron to us. And Collishaw was the on the other side. He was the next aerodrome to us over the road. They shot us up. We dashed for these trenches and just laid
no
low.
No warning at all either.
Laid low in the trenches, you see, and they shot up. They put some bullets through some of our machines, and the hangars were full of bullet holes, but that was not, they weren't after us, they were after the other squadron, but they just...
Come by just to let you know they were there.
Yeah, of course, we'd been doing that to them very frequently, you see, shooting them up. So anyway, well, the first flight up, the OC came to me and said, what altitude have you been at? And I said, well, 8,000 is the highest I've been. What? 8,000? I said, yes, at Houghton Park, at 4 TDS, I was up. 8,000 is the highest I've been. You take that machine and go up over Amiens to 15,000 feet right now. Okay, I got in left shin and I was up Amiens and I went up to 15,000 feet and I came down with a headache. My first altitude flight.
I see.
But speaking of altitude flying, though, the more you get of altitude flying, the better you like it. You see, you want to be, the higher you can get, the better all the time. You feel so much better at the high altitude. Yes, oh, it's great. Great up there. None of this close to the ground stuff.
You want to get up in there?
Right up in the ceiling. And fortunately, 23 Squadron was a ceiling squadron. We didn't, the only squadron in France that didn't carry bombs, even the little fellas. Because we were to work on the ceiling at 20,000 feet, you see. And, pretty soon we got a call. The boys had been making good progress on the ground. And so we were moved from Bertangles to a place called Cappy Chateau. And that's where Richthofen had been a few weeks before he was killed. So we took that same aerodrome over.
You mean Richthofen, the Germans held that aerodrome, you mean? You're taking the German aerodrome?
When they pushed us back to near the Amiens, he had been located in Cappy Chateau.
So this is originally an RFC aerodrome that Richthofen commandeered, and then you commandeered
As they came along, they picked up anything they could pick up,
sure,
you see.
Sure,
So that was our next move. Well, there, it was summertime, we were living in tents in an orchard, and our mess was in, it was a ruined chateau, but there was enough left to the basement that we could have our mess there, place, you see. But we slept in tents. And all for practice, we'd be set up, they'd set up a piece, they'd put a sheet metal on the ground somewhere, they'd say, all right, go up and fire at that, so on. All this just gave us flying whenever they could, they had machines to
spare. You hadn't come in contact with the enemy at all yet.
Oh no, not for a long time. So that was it. But the incident, there were two or three of us. This metal sheet was out there, but there were two or three of us lying on the side of the orchard. It was hot in the summer. We just had our shirts on, you see.
Yeah, I've talked myself for it.
And so this fellow was up, and doggone if he didn't fire at us.
I don't know.
We were light, you see, and he was looking for something bright to fire at the sheet of metal instead of the bullets. So we got up and dashed off.
Oh, no.
All sorts of things that could happen. And eventually, they'd send us up to patrol, singly. Patrol, you see. I was sent up several times. Go up and patrol the balloon line. Make sure there's no Heinies come over and shoot down our balloons. You're responsible.
Mm-hmm.
All right, get up there to 17,000 feet. And stay above them. Make sure that nobody comes over. Now one day I went up, I was sent out on balloon patrol, and I spotted a two-seater up above me, and he was taking pictures on our side of the line. He was a big machine. And I said, I better go after him. And I had a lot of practice. I told how to fly in his blind spot all the time, you see. If he'd make a right turn, I'd go out this way, you see, so I was always between his tail, and if he'd make a left turn, I'd go out this way, you see, and climb, 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 climb. And he was taking pictures, and he was climbing too, but he didn't see me. But I got up to 23,000 feet in that machine, and I couldn't get any higher.
This
was what has happened. I was what they call hanging on my prop. It was just, I'd maybe go up a little and then sink back, and up a little, sink back. And he still hadn't spotted me. I said, well, he's 2,000 feet above me. I can't hit him with anything at that distance. So I just scare him off. So I fired my two machine guns at him. A couple of heads came over the side of the fuselage. He just turned, put his nose down a little bit, a big heavy machine, and he was off like a shot back home. I couldn't attempt to follow him. I was in such thin air there that my machine didn't, my propeller wouldn't grasp the air hardly at all. I was at my absolute ceiling. And that's the highest I ever got in France, was 23,000 feet. But a lot of fellows never got over 19,000 feet. It depended on your weight and how good your motor was. You know, we had a terrible time from then on with our motors. Espanos vis-a-vis 200 horsepower motors.
Mm-hmm.
And there were two or three firms in France making them. But they were so desperate for motors, there were so many crack-ups, that they were taking a half a V8 cylinder, half a V8 motor from this crash and a half from another crash, and grinding them together, and giving us that. Well, the vibration is so terrific. There was nothing smooth about them. They just vibrated, waiting for them to jump out of the motor. And we lost more fellows with dud engines before November than we did any other way. And I had so many forced landings in France with dud engines. And the only reason I'm here today is because of that experience I had in Cheshire, day after day,
forced landings.
Saved my bacon in France a good many times. For instance, I was up over balloon patrol another day, and my engine stopped just like that. I thought the engine was going to jump out of the plane. And my gosh, I was right over the Hindenburg line. And this area for 30 miles back, 40 miles back, was one shell hole touching another shell hole. There wasn't a clear bit of soil anywhere. I said, well, I'll volplane as far back as I can, but I'll see if I can find a road or find some place that I could possibly get down. No, I wasn't very high. I was only at 12 or 13,000 feet, so I didn't have very much distance to get back. I've simply got to land among those shell holes. That's all there is to it. I can't get a kick out of it. There's no, my motor is absolutely out. And so I came down. As I got closer to ground looking for a place to land, I could see a track. I don't know whether it was a footpath or a horse path or something. I said, well, there's a 1% advantage anyway. I'll try for that. So I came down very gingerly and felt for the ground. And just as I was going to land, what did I see but a row of poles about 10 or 12 feet high, all colors, you see, and a whole string of communication wires on it. I said, my gosh, the Fifth Army communication, the whole army. So what did I do? Automatically bounced my wheels, bounced over and landed on the other side.
Just like
in France. And that saved my bacon, and it also saved the whole Fifth Army communications. And saved me too. I landed, and I don't suppose the machine rolled more than the width of this room before it stopped. And it was going like this, one shell hole to the other. And I got out. I looked in front of my propeller, straight down about 30 feet into a gun pit. And I lifted the cowl on my motor, and what do you suppose? There was a hole in the sump, and the aluminum sump that big. The crankshaft had burst, had broken. And the crank just burst.
Pounded right through.
Yeah, pounded right out through a big chunk of the masonry.
Well, wasn't there a lot of must have been a lot of complaining?
Oh, everybody was complaining. You know something? We used to, after it happened in Washington, we'd pray that we'd get a Peugeot motor, a Peugeot, Hispano Suiza. Peugeot was one of the two or three firms that were building them. Peugeot Motors, Hispano Suiza were pretty good, they were smooth, but the others were terrible. And another thing that we hated was this, that when an engine had done 100 hours, it automatically went to the depot.
Whether it needed it or not.
Whether it was in good condition or not. And we used to detest that because beautiful money wrote it. All for revamping, you see, two issues. And what would come back? One of these built-up motors that almost jump out of the plane when you revved it up. And so that everybody was just hoping they'd get a new Peugeot. Boy, not much luck. Every once in a while somebody'd get one, but... Oh, we'd... well, if you could see the logbook, it'd be the oil line, the engine oil line would break. And you'd have to come down because your oil pressure had gone completely. Otherwise your engine would catch fire eventually. That'd be one. The next thing would be that, you see, we had gears, the two Vickers fired through the propeller. One fired 1250 and the other 750 through the propeller. And the Constantinescu gear was a little copper oil line attached to a cam on the boss of the propeller, and those pulses came back to the trigger. And when you pressed the trigger, those pulses fired the gun, you see.
And your propeller would be vertical.
Well, yes, yeah. Right. But the propeller would be whizzing around.
Whizzing around with the bend,
Is it missing? Well,
did you trust that?
I've had that oil line burst, that oil line burst, you see. What a sitting duck. I couldn't fire my guns. What happens? You have to go back home. Or make a forced landing. Get back home.
This may be a silly question, but is there any fear at all that you'd be firing someday and just shoot your propeller off?
No, it rarely happened. It used to happen occasionally at the beginning, but it usually wouldn't shoot it off. It just put a hole through it. But some of them, because they were so laminated, they would take quite a bit. You see, it was about six or seven layers of wood laminated and glued together, so that a bullet at that speed would usually go right through it without splintering it very much. So originally, they did splinter right to pieces. Yeah.
That wasn't the big fear. It was just everything else was garbage, though, is that right?
Yeah. But if your oil line burst while you've had it, you see, you can get away out of it as quick as you can. And another thing that's happened to me outside of... Oh, yes. I had break. And then two days later, I had the camshaft break. If you can imagine that. Same thing, the camshaft.
The equipment was just worn out.
Oh,
and just
terrible condition.
Scandalous shape.
Bits and pieces put together. And... but when we were at the second place at Cappy, here's the thing that happened. I forget where I'd been. I was sent up to do something. And suddenly the old things started to rock, shake to beat the cars. I said, what the hell is wrong here? So I finally shut the motor off. And then I realized what it was. Our engines were geared. They're geared from 200 horsepower up to 225 horsepower. The fellow was on a gear. Well, this gear in my machine had broken loose, and the gear was sawing off my propeller at the boss.
Oh, God.
At the hub. And it was more than halfway through. And when I realized what was happening, so I lifted up so as to stop the propeller and landed absolutely dead propeller, you see, and landed on the aerodrome.
So,
all right.
So the equipment
wasn't too far away. But here was the propeller almost sawed off, you see. You can't imagine the number of things that could go wrong with a high-speed aluminum motor that was in poor condition.
Oh.
I made needle trouble one day. There's something almost every day or up.
Well, just a lot of grumbling in the squad?
Oh, yes, everybody was grumbling, but...
That was all part of the game, eh?
Yeah. There weren't enough engines to go around, and they were so busy building engines for the American Air Force that they... We would take the scraps, I guess, out of about the size of it, although a lot of our boys were Americans.
Yeah.
Our squadron was made up. Well, there'd be, about six Canadians, about five Americans. There'd be a couple of Englishmen, Scotchmen and Irishmen, Bermudan, South African, a New Zealander, maybe a couple of New Zealanders in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
That's the sort of a mix we had.
And I.
Oh, God, well.
Okay.
But
take a break for 1 second here.
Yeah. Do you want to pull that there? But I have to go over it and touch it up and put in some things and take out some things.
Okay. My name's Chris Mann. I'm with Mr. W.W. McGill. And it's August 10, 1978, and we're in Victoria. And we left off. You had left Bert Angles.
Bert Angles.
And had gone to Cappy.
Cappy.
Which was Rick Toppin's old base, but it had been bombed out.
Yeah. And then finally from there, we moved forward as they broke through quite odd parts of the Hindenburg line, and they were forcing the Germans back, you see. So we were trying to follow up, and then we moved to a place called Hancourt, which
now, is this where you had the problem that you'd mentioned, where you had the forced landing? Was this when you were at Cappy, or where you had the forced landing, you had to jump over the communication lines at the Fifth Army?
I'm not sure whether we were at Cappy or Hancourt.
Because you mentioned at the time it was the Hindenburg line.
Yes, well, we were always just back of the Hindenburg line, and we were, as they were advancing, we were following up, you see.
I see.
And, it might have been Hancourt, yes, that took off that day, and it was not only this one, but that was the broken crankshaft. But a day or two after, I had a broken camshaft with a forced landing in somewhat the same area.
Same, through the shell holes.
Yes, only it was a little further back and a little north of the other. We were in a different location. But we weren't at Hancourt very long until there was another advance over the Hindenburg line, and we followed through and went to a place called Bertry, which was just southwest of the Canadian front.
What, the Vimy business?
No. They were at, I'd have to have the map here to name the places. Le Cateau was, they'd gone through Le Cateau and straight through there. And they were approaching the area where they finished the war, in other words. But at Bertry, supposing I give you this armistice day, this covers quite a little bit of it, an armistice day episode.
Mm-hmm.
3 hours one morning. A few minutes after 6 a.m., the siren screams its warning. Early morning show. Come awake. Pull on the woolen long johns and jet pullers. Then the hip-high wool inside sheepskin boots. Then the Sitka double-breasted flying suit with the convenient above-the-knee pockets. A cup of coffee and a bite of food and out into the night to the drone. The motors are still ticking over, are all ticking over, being warmed up by each plane's mechanics. I climb into the cockpit of Sopwith Dolphin E of A Flight, don flying helmet, chamois-lined leather, buckle up the belt, then the helmet chin strap, and pull down the goggles, leaving only my nostrils exposed. Now to pull on the black silk-fingered gloves, and over them fingered woolen gloves, then finally sealskin gauntlets with thumb and trigger forefinger. All this in an open cockpit, because up there, just under 20,000 feet, it's frequently 60 below zero. This is November
1918.
Yeah. Now we line up in formation for takeoff, my position being first left of the leader. A Flight is to lead today. Lieutenant Huntley Sinclair, Sink, we call him, as the leader of A Flight, is flying a streamer from a right-hand strut, and so automatically is leader of the squadron on this dawn patrol. A Flight has five planes serviceable. B and C flights are in a bad way, with only a total of 7 planes serviceable, so they will form one combined flight. With a gloved hand wave signal from sync, we rev up, move in formation, full throttle, feeling the ground with the increasing speed into the night. Our flaming exhausts help us to keep formation as we lift off into the early morning darkness. The watch with illuminated dial on the instrument board says it's 6:38 a.m. Daylight will come in 30 to 40 minutes. It's that time of year. We are climbing, up, west towards the channel. And at about 10,000 feet, we pull up the plunger that puts the Constantinesco gear oil column under pressure so that the trigger, when pressed, actuates the two Vickers guns to fire, one 750, the other 1250 per minute, through the propeller without hitting the fast-spinning propeller blades. I test a burst, both guns firing okay. Now we turn around and head east into the dawn. Up with 225 horsepower to 17 or 18,000 feet. It's sunup now. We arrive over our ceiling patrol area, Tuin, T-H-U-I-N, to Chimay, C-H-I-M-A-Y. Today the motor hums smoothly and the squadron has arrived complete. That's extraordinary. We haven't lost anybody with a dud engine. To some of us, it was an exasperating experience to have a smooth-running V8 Espanasuiza motor taken out for overhaul after 100 hours and sent to Isha's depot. The replacement turns out to be a poor, reconstructed, makeshift thing which keeps you constantly on edge. Many other things can go wrong with an aluminum high-speed
just
motor in poor shape.
Just a minute. Just wait a minute.
You're bursting in on our...
Oh, mercy.
We're back on the air here. When did you write this?
Oh, I wrote this a couple of months ago. My granddaughter had given me a book on aviation for Christmas, as a matter of fact.
That's right.
And she had looked to make sure that there was something about the Suffolk Dolphin, and they found one picture in it about the Suffolk Dolphin. But I didn't discover this at Christmas. We were away to Honolulu for a month. It came back in January, and I hadn't talked very much about it, but on a Sunday afternoon, somebody was here, and they picked up this book and were looking at it. And so I pointed out this picture of the Suffolk Dolphin, the type of machine I'd flown, you see. And the thought occurred to me, say, there's 3 numbers visible. There was about a dozen machines there in
right.
the process of manufacture, but I could see the numbers on 3 of the fuselages. I said, wait, go get my logbook and look through. And here I discovered one of these planes in the illustration was a plane that I flew in France. Number C, what was it? It was C-3785. And so I got out my logbook and I wrote this down for my daughter to type out, you see, about that particular numbered plane.
C-3785, the
dates and everything, you see. And then I'd done that a few weeks afterwards. Daughter did this, and I said, oh, I think I'll just write a little something for the grandchildren. They all seem to be interested in this.
Certainly.
And they had. So the thought occurred to me, how about telling about that last day, November the 11th, and this is it. But, you see, Trudy got hold of this after I'd written it and dashed down to the colonists with it.
Oh, good.
And Merriman wants it for the Islander, you see.
Well, I think that's
great. And so I said, oh, I didn't write for publication. This is just for the kids. And, yes, but Trudy says it's interesting to not only the kids, but to other people. And they'd like to. I said, well, I want to, 2 things I want to do. I want to think it over and maybe correct some things or put some things in that haven't come to mind right now. And first, I want to show it to Huntley Sinclair, who I'll be meeting in Edmonton in May at the World One More Flyers get-together in Edmonton. And I want him to read it over and okay it. as the leader of the squadron that day. And then if that's all right, why, maybe you can have it. I would like it not to be published till Armistice Day or just before. Oh, Marion says, let things go that long before and somebody's passed out or something and I haven't got it. So, but that's where it stands now. And I said, well, you want a couple of pictures. I've got one on the wall and I've got to hunt that negative. And I hunted for weeks and couldn't find the negative. So finally I took this down and had it reprinted. And it's in there. And I also wanted to get that picture behind you, you see, with Humphrey and I. So that, those two pictures will be shown probably.
Very good.
With the article. And this is the article, but I still have to do a little revamping on it. But
we'll continue on.
Let's see, we were up over the front. Oh yes, we were talking about
this. You hadn't lost a plane.
About the poor motor, but you've had this before, I think. Many other things go wrong with an aluminum high-speed motor in poor shape, such as a broken crankshaft or camshaft.
Right.
Well, to conk out under circumstance over the front lines means an unhealthy prospect of forced landing on shell-pocked areas fought over back and forth as our Hindenburg front was just north of St. Quentin. I've been really lucky several times having just these things happen. Maybe we better close that door. It's bumping every little while.
Okay, I'll get it.
The climb towards the channel and back up to the front at patrol altitude would usually eliminate the decrepit ones before arriving. But even at that, we would lose an occasional conk out over the enemy side. Today, no one suffered the agony of slipping out of formation back down with a spitting, spluttering, shuddering, bucking, recalcitrant motor, hoping to find a little stretch of level ground on which to land right side up, if possible. Today, we're on the ceiling, too Anne to see me. Strange? No Archie. No friend. No foe in sight. And no evident activity below. So sink edges off east with a let's go touring stance. Normally on patrol, we fly in echelon like Canada geese on long jaunts, except that each plane to the rear is stepped up in height. Leader of the lower flight leads the squadron. Number two flight is to the left and 500 to 1,000 feet above, and number three flight to the right and 500 to 1,000 feet above number two. Today, we are in only two flights with B and C, the other flight about 1,000 feet above us. We are off east now, well behind the enemy front lines. We had a feeling, a hunch, the last day or two, that things seemed to be winding down, especially in the air. But not a word have we heard from the OC or squadron office. Now Sink decides to look things over to the south. Except by looking at the map, we are not familiar with the topography below. But it's an interesting tour at 18,000 feet on a nice, bright, cloudless morning, all on our own. All is well. And we are over the Forêt d'Ardennes, the forest of the Ardennes, when, oops, all hell breaks loose. To go back to 6:38 a.m., we later learned that word came to the squadron a few minutes after we had taken off that we were to stay on the ground. Various lights were fired at us to attract our attention and bring us back down. But we were climbing and looking into the dawn, oblivious to anything happening below. Who would be looking down into the dark? We were out to meet the upcoming sun, and so we were not supposed to be in the air at all. We were the whole show this morning, the whole show ourselves. And at that moment, we were interlopers, intruders over the forest of the Ardennes. Nobody should have been in the air, but we were. So horrors at altitude 17,000, all at once, 15 shell bursts all around and among our five planes of A-flight, totally unexpected and unanticipated. They had our range absolutely accurately. Four batteries, 16 guns, caught us because we were winging along placidly, sitting ducks. The bursts were so close in front, I could smell the cordite, and shrapnel was screaming around on all sides, sideslipping this way and that, and climbing and diving like chips on a turbulent sea, surrounded by and leaving behind a huge trailing cloud of black smoke. We attempted to outwit the ack-ack. Today, Archie was not just a few somewhat distant but audible coughs. That's what they sound like in the air. But multiple splitting explosions right at hand, and shrapnel too close for comfort. In attempting to shake Archie off, we had lost 3,000 or 4,000 feet. But, to our dismay, he still stuck with us. That terrible, what a terrible 10 minutes, though it seemed much longer as we tossed about. To give Archie his due, we had never experienced such accurate marksmanship from the ground. Ordinarily, with the one battery, four guns set up, we simply disdained ack-ack. Now, finally, we outranged him, relieved that there were no direct hits. Meanwhile, the other flight, 1,000 feet above us, were laughing at us in our distressing dilemma, for they had only one gun working on them while we had 15 on us. Now that we were clear and intact as to casualties, what was this schmozzle all about? Well, at 8:38 a.m., as we landed back home and taxied to our respective canvas hangars, shut off the motor, unbuckled, raised goggles, held nose and swallowed to adjust to zero altitude, both mechanics came rushing up, all excited about something. "The war is over, sir! The war is over, sir!" Still smarting from that pounding from Archie, our answer, "So why were they so nearly, why were we so nearly blasted out of the sky a few minutes ago?" It began to dawn on us when mention was made of the various lights after takeoff 2 hours before. It really wasn't the tourist season after all. We were out of touch with affairs of the war on the ground at headquarters. On checking with Sink and the three other pals of A-Flight, found that only first left and second right were scot-free. All the rest were all the other three were damaged. And first, second, my opposite on the right, and third, my rear, had all returned with scars from the affair. Only myself, first left, and pal, second right, were unscathed. These were the ups and downs of 3 hours one morning, a final dawn patrol, a rather special one. For 2 hours later, the armistice was signed, ending World War I. But now, we could relax and enjoy breakfast, and lo, prohibited campers appeared from nowhere. Boys, just think of it. This four-year unpleasantness is over. A spot of celebration is in order. Finally, I cannot forget the presence of my guardian angel, not just for today, not just for the months in the air, from Bert Angles to Bertry, not for the months and months of narrow squeaks in training in Canada, Texas, England, and Scotland, during which times I mourn the many, many fine friends I lost. War is hell.
That's very good.
It has to be re-edited here and there, fixed up. But that pretty well finishes.
When it just about does it.
Mind you, we had to do a protective patrol for November, December, January.
So it's part of the blockade.
February and March, yes, behind the line. We moved into Belgium,
yes.
And we stayed in one place there until we had orders one day, and I'd have to look in my logbook to give you the date. We flew to a place in France called Tourmenes, T-O-U-R-M-I-N-G-I-N-E-S, Tourmenes. It was a demobilization depot. We flew in there, signed a sheet of paper, turned our machines over, and said goodbye to the plane. The bus there to take us to a train for back to England.
And how were you demobilized in England then? You're with the Royal RAF, you're not with...
Yes, it was RAF then there. Well, now that you mention that, it happened, two of us had had long service. Another chap and myself in the squadron had been there longest. So we were given a preference. We could either go onto home defense in England, or go with the rest for the possibility of sometime or other getting back to Canada, you see. And this chap made that. He said, maybe you'd get away quicker going on home defense. So we said, we'll go on home defense. We want to get back home. It turned out to be the opposite, though. We went to home defense, went to London, and we were sent out to Winchester and two or three other aerodromes where there were a lot of fellows on home defense, you see. And finally, we went out to number one flying school in Wiltshire, Upavon. And we sat there till July.
1919.
Finally, we got an order to depart for Liverpool. And got on the ship home. But some of the boys had gotten away earlier. There were still some of them left behind besides us, but that was it. Back to England, we arrived back Quebec. We met in Quebec by the Salvation Army, who threw oranges on board. We stopped there just for a few minutes and then to Montreal. And
the big victory celebrations when you come back, or has this all been pretty much over now?
Remember now, you're back in August 1919.
This is what I'm getting at, yeah.
Yeah, oh yes, no.
Just Salvation Army there to let you home, eh?
That was all, oh yes. It was old hat now, you see. They're just the dregs coming home.
Did you go to Toronto and spend time with your family?
Well, I went down and visited my two or three families in Ontario, sisters and brothers and mother and so on. With the idea that maybe I would go back in pharmacy in Ontario. But after about a week down there and looking at such a no.
Back up to Vancouver?
No, Ontario. Back to the coast, the mountains and the sea.
Vancouver again, sir?
That's the only place. So we came back to Vancouver, and I had met up in Toronto with two chaps who were school teachers, and they were heading out to Vancouver to teach school. One was in the, they were both in the artillery, and I had met one of them before. He was a cousin of a chap that I used to work with in Ontario. So, back to Vancouver, we got together and we decided to take a flat and match it, you see. So we did that. We did that for a while. The other boys taught high school in South Vancouver.